So a few reflections, more reflections on the topic I brought up in the guided meditation around effort and ways to support the mind being here. The first piece around gently having persistent effort. You know, our orientation often is about the making of effort in our lives, in much that we do. You know, we apply our effort to do things. And as the meditation begins to develop, as the mindfulness gains momentum, sometimes we don't recognize that it has gained momentum and we're making effort that's not necessary. And sometimes even when it feels like, you know, paradoxically sometimes when it feels like the mindfulness is slipping out, you know, kind of getting lost more, especially after we've been practicing for a while, you know, we think, oh, you know, I'm not working as hard, I better work more. But paradoxically, sometimes at that point, it's actually useful to have a lighter touch of effort. For example, a reason why that might be the case is that at one point I brought up the use of a question, you know, what am I not seeing right now? That may be more what kind of effort would be useful in that case, because sometimes what's going on is that as the mindfulness settles, the mindfulness starts getting interested in subtler kinds of stuff, not the things that we're familiar with being with or knowing or looking at. And so the mindfulness starts getting interested in subtler kinds of things that we may not be so consciously attuned to. And if we are bringing in to say, well, I need to stay mindful, if we're making that effort, then what we're trying to stay mindful of usually is things we already know, things we're already familiar with. We know how to be with body sensations, for instance, and so we may kind of say, okay, I'm going to be with my body. But what's going on in the mind is much subtler, perhaps, or what's going on in that time is subtler maybe than body sensations. And that effort to kind of stay, I'm going to be mindful, is maybe obscuring what's going on that the mindfulness is actually more interested in, the subtler kinds of phenomenon. So two things about that. One is that our minds tend to pay attention to when we're consciously making effort, our minds may tend to gravitate towards things that we already know, as opposed to the more new, kind of unfamiliar things. And then the very making of that effort, the very doing of that, I'm going to stay mindful, remembering to be aware, that kind of churning along of that, can get in the way. It's like that's a more gross function in the mind than some of what the mindfulness can see. And so over time, we may find, sometimes I found a question really useful, especially after I've been practicing for a while, and then the mindfulness starts feeling like it's slipping out more. Sometimes I use those questions like, what am I missing? What am I not seeing? What else is happening? But sometimes I also just play with backing off of the effort. It's like, how little effort do I need to be here? You know, can I make less effort? Like, play with that. Play with letting go of the effort and just seeing. Like, okay, what if I let go of the effort a little bit more? And I've seen a lot of times that there can be a lot more release of effort, of that conscious making of effort, than I would have imagined. And so that's an invitation at times to play with the level of effort. We have so many views about needing to make effort to do things that as we enter into the mindfulness practice, we're bringing that habit to our practice. And so playing with, well, what about making less effort? What happens? I've even played with it to the point of like being willing to let the mind wander. It's like, oh yeah, that's not quite enough. I need a little bit more than that. So that's one piece. Something about questions came to my mind. I can't remember it now, so I'll leave that one. Another piece that I wanted to elaborate a little bit more on is using wisdom. I suggested sometimes when there's a struggle happening in the mind, it can be useful to bring in some wisdom that we've heard, wisdom that we've understood, simple kinds of wisdoms like, I just remembered the other piece. Simple kinds of wisdoms like, right, this will change. It's impermanent. It's just this. And we can remember these, or there's different ways that we can do this. We can do this consciously, like remembering, Sayadaw calls this borrowing wisdom. You know, when we don't feel like we have access to our own internal understanding of this is impermanent. At the same time, reminding ourselves of that we've heard that from our teachers, from reading, from other talks we've heard. So just bringing that in, bringing it in to just remind ourselves, right, this will change. Sometimes that can help the mind to loosen its kind of tightness around what's happening. And if you see, sometimes we can kind of see, you know, the tightness might be around some kind of particular stuckness, some kind of particular belief. Like, you know, so for instance, if the mind is somehow thinking or believing, you know, I'm always like this. This is who I am. Then a reminder, a wisdom reminder to kind of, you know, point to the not true nature of that might be something like, this is conditions happening right now. So sometimes we can find a wisdom that's directly connected to the struggle, but you know, I wouldn't like try to do that. That's a little bit more work. Sometimes that happens more naturally. So some basic, I mean, so the basic wisdom reflections in terms of the deeper understanding are around impermanent, unreliable, and not self. And the not self piece can be expressed more maybe familiarly or comfortably in the mind with something like, this is nature. This is just what's happening because of conditions. So we can borrow wisdom from our teachers, and then what happens? So this is speaking in some ways to the different levels of wisdom that the Buddha speaks about. The first level of wisdom being the wisdom of things we've heard. So bringing that in, bringing in things that we've heard, things that we've read that can support us. And this is more wisdom about the experience level, not wisdom about content. So this is not like, okay, so, you know, I know that it's true that that person said that thing and then they did that. It's not about that. It's more at the experience level, impermanent, unreliable, conditioned nature of experience, not self. And then as we bring that in, as we bring those wisdom reflections in, our mind begins to kind of, in a way, just bringing that in, our minds begin to massage that a little bit. Like, just use that wisdom. And that's the second level of wisdom, the wisdom of reflection. And not that we're trying to consciously think about this. Let the process, I mean, so very naturally when we bring thoughts into the mind, our mind does something with them, kind of like we explored that first morning of I dropped some words in and the mind did something with them. We can drop wisdom in and the mind will do something with it. This is the natural reflective capacity of our minds. And so we don't have to try to think about this. just bringing it in, and then the mind will start to think about or to reflect and to use that wisdom in some way. Sometimes, not always. Sometimes I've brought wisdom in and the mind has stayed really tightly stuck. But sometimes there's a little more space, a little more, oh, right. Okay, I can hold that a little bit more easily, reflecting on that wisdom. So we can borrow wisdom from our teachers, from books, from things we've heard. We can also borrow wisdom from ourselves. There can be times when we've learned something, we've had an understanding or an insight, and it's not available to us, the lived experience of that insight. So there are times when we see something so clearly, it's like, oh, this is impermanent. And it's like, it feels different than, oh, this is impermanent, thinking about it. There's a lived understanding of that. And so that kind of lived understanding is the third level of wisdom, the wisdom of understanding and insight. And that is where the mind becomes able to really let go. That wisdom frees the mind. That wisdom, that understanding allows the mind to let go. That's not something we do. Wisdom creates the conditions for that letting go to happen. And yet there are times when after we've had an understanding or insight, it's not like our normal knowledge where we can just go back and say, oh, I know that thing, you know, that I can remember something. We can remember things sometimes, but it doesn't go into that kind of experiential place. And yet sometimes we can recall understandings that we've had. And because we've had them, because they have been lived, they can have a potency when we remember them, when we remind ourselves of them, they can have a potency that helps us release and let go. So an example from my own, and another piece about this is that when we have those understanding and those insights, sometimes our mind expresses it in words. Sometimes it just is felt, but sometimes it kind of filters up, because our minds do this. Our minds express things in language, and sometimes it kind of filters up through our system into our conscious kind of verbalizing mind, and our mind says a thought, says some words that connect to that understanding. If that has happened for you, sometimes that language becomes very resonant. So an example for me, I was exploring self-hatred noticing a whole lot around the self-hatred and really kind of curious about the feeling and the arising of the feeling and, you know, just the unpleasant nature of things. And so I was just really curious about it. And in a moment, at one point in seeing, so there was quite a bit of continuity in watching the self-hatred. It was kind of popping in and out. And at one point, the self-hatred arose, and the mind in that moment understood. So the way it expressed itself in the mind, this is just a thought. So that language, you know, that language of this is just a thought, was an expression of the understanding, basically, that I mean, it collapsed a whole kind of bunch of things. The seeing of the arising of the self-hatred was understood as there's a thought that's coming in, and the mind is believing it. The mind is kind of inclining to believing that thought, but it's just a thought. And there's no power to that thought other than what the belief gives it. And that belief is just a belief. So that whole understanding, which was what the insight kind of allowed there to be this immediate like kind of release. I went from self-hatred to bliss in like a split second. You know, it's like it was just a falling apart of that pattern. And that was expressed in the mind as this is just a thought. And so the next, you know, for the next day or so, anything that arose that the mind was a little bit attached to, I could simply remember, this is just X. Oh, this is just resistance. This is just confusion. And the mind would, you know, just release it. Because it was so close to the insight, you know, so close. And the use of that language, it was like that use of that language for the day or so following that experience kind of like brought me back to remember viscerally that experience. And so sometimes when, you know, we can use the language of our teachers and that can help us get going. But what I'd say is for myself, what I've seen is that as my mind practices, there's language that my mind expresses the truth in. That's resonant for this being. And that's the language that's best in terms of my, you know, kind of reflections, if I'm using reflections, wisdom reflections to support me. So the of course, that one's another one that came up for me. Like the seeing, oh, well, self-hatred. Of course self-hatred's arising. You know, look at the conditioning. Look at the history. It's like, of course. And so that language was very resonant for me. The this is nature language Sayadaw offered also ended up being very resonant for me as I began to understand what it meant, how he meant that, and it became my own. And so, you know, what I'd like to suggest or encourage is notice the language that your mind uses in terms of its understanding. That's the language that will support you. And like we all see how we all have different understandings for words. And the whatever words resonate for you, that's useful. That's useful to connect with, to support that wisdom. Does that make sense? Okay. And then the other piece I remembered, the piece I wanted to elaborate a little bit about the questions. So in terms of our meditation practice, I'd say the questions that we're inclining towards, the curiosity questions here, you know, like, you know, what else is happening right now? Or what am I not seeing? What's happening in the body right now? Those kinds of questions. The investigation questions. And sometimes the word investigation, people have a relationship with that word and think it means pulling apart, figuring out, a very active kind of doing, digging kind of thing. And there can be a way in which the mind will do that sometimes, but also there is a way that just finding supports for landing with experience, being with experience. That is a form of investigation, and the questions can support that. Can I just be with this a little bit more? So that it's a very gentle kind of thing. Saita Upandita used to use this kind of image about connecting. And he used a cloth and a bowl, and he said, this is how we connect. We connect with a cloth, soft cloth, touching the bowl like this. You know, we don't take a hammer and try to, like, break it apart to try to figure out what's going on with this. We, you know, connect. Can we just be with it in this way? Connect. And that just being with is a form of investigation. And there's a kind of a trust for us because, again, in our lives, in our habitual way of learning and understanding, that kind of digging has often served us. You know, if we're in a math class and it's just like, oh, can I just be with this teacher saying these words? It's like, probably not going to get into learning all of the complexity of that. And yet in our meditation, there's a very deep understanding that can happen just in the, can I hold this? Can I be with this? That is a form of investigation. And so the questions for investigation are about the questions that take us into that being with, not so much questions, definitely not questions about the content of what's going on in our mind. So not questions about, what should I do about that? What that person said? That's not the kind of question to ask in the meditation. There is a place for that kind of question in the kind of reflective practice that we've explored, the 50-50 mindfulness, and that came up yesterday, you know, the kind of, how should I respond to this, you know, how should I write this letter? So that there's a way that, you know, you can use that kind of question and be with your experience to help you find a way to, through some situation in our lives. And that's useful, but I would call that reflective practice, not the meditation practice so much. And so the kinds of questions for our meditation are more pointing us into this moment, this experience. There was one more thing. And I can't remember it, so I want to open it up for you. What? First to just check in, are there any comments or questions about this topic around questions, using wisdom, making effort, and, you know, if not, we can just move into the shares. I'll add this. Sometimes in that curiosity, sometimes questions, we bring questions in sometimes consciously to help us, especially when we're struggling, you know. And sometimes having some go-to questions can be useful, like, well, what else is going on here? Or something, you know, just something to help point us in. But sometimes the questions arise. They're not what we're trying to do. And that's more like wisdom is kind of, you know, beginning to take the lead, and that the questions just come up. And it can be useful to notice, you know, it's not to use those as oh, that's just a thought, go back. It's like those thoughts actually can help to support our practice. So it's an interesting like little balance of knowing that it's a thought, but also understanding that content is impactful on the experience. Often when the questions just arise, there's a closer connection to understanding. Yeah. So a question around, you know, basically the use of the phrase, you know, when we say something like, well, how is the mind relating to this? What does that mean? How do we understand that? So what I would say is, the first piece that comes into my mind is it's a way to make the question more impersonal than how am I relating to this. So that's one piece that it kind of helps the mind to not be kind of congealing around that identity of I am, to use that language. So that's one piece, that it serves that purpose. And then what we mean by how does the mind relate to this is what, so there's the mind, in one way of looking at the mind consists of many processes. You know, there's the, in the teaching on the five aggregates, there are four mental processes at work in our human experience. The body is one of the five aggregates, and then the other four aggregates are mental processes, and those, every experience is comprised of those five things, and those four, feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, perception, the ability to recognize, mental formations, all of the emotions, thoughts, moods, beliefs, mind states, all, that's huge, a huge category, and then the capacity to know. And so all four of those kind of make up what the mind is, you make up the mind, the processes of mind. And so those processes are actually responsible for relating to experience.
See, I just got lost there.
Okay.
That's where I get lost, exactly at yep. That point.
Great, fine. All right, so like for instance, the way that I know experience, you know, so I'm sitting in this room, and there is some physical experience, so I'm seeing, that's physical. And then the mind has a feeling, you know, some pieces of the experience are pleasant, some pieces are unpleasant. Mostly it's neutral. You know, there's not a lot of pleasant. I mean, it's actually, there's quite a lot of pleasant too, actually, as now I reflect on it. It's like, this is a very relaxing place to be. And so there's some pleasant in here. There's, you know, a little bit of messiness there. The stain on the carpet, that's a little unpleasant, you know. So there's a range of pleasant, unpleasant. That's that first mental process. And when we take in information, and it can come from physical contact, taste, sight, sound. The mind relates to it, you know, kind of processes it, let's say, with these four processes. And one of them is the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral aspect. That's one way we're taking in information into our minds. Another way is the perception process, the recognition. I look out and I recognize people and chairs and carpet and floor and wall and window. You know, that's, again, the mind is doing that. I don't have to try to do that. The mind is making those connections all for us. You know, it's like I'm not doing that. So that's another aspect. That's a huge aspect. That's another important aspect of our experience, to recognize that our mind is doing that perceptual process. And then I'm going to skip mental formations right now and go to the knowing. That's another big way. It's like the whole way that the experience is actually kind of processed is through this knowing. It's like there's a sight and the knowing of it, the sound and the knowing of it, body sensation and the knowing of it, a thought and the knowing of it. So there's the knowing and the thing known. So these three, the feeling, perception, and knowing, or consciousness is the word, translation usually of that aggregate. Those three are kind of the experience that's given. That's what we take in a moment. And our mind is taking it in and making that happen.
Does the mind filter? I mean, does the mind filter that?
Being recorded?
Yes.
Okay.
Does the mind takes that information in, and then does the mind filter that information? I mean,
there's a lot of filtering going on.
Right.
Yes, and some of that happens in the perceptual area. Yet most of it happens kind of in the mental formation area. Our views, our opinions, our ideas, beliefs affect what we know. So it's not just that we're taking in things as kind of cameras and microphones. You know, it's like the mind is very active in the creation of what it's taking in.
So we're taking all of these things, and then the mind, that's...
Well, we actually, the process of filtering can happen first. Mm-hmm. It's like we think about it happening second, but it's very, very dynamic. And so, you know, an example of this, if you have an agenda, you may have heard about this study. It's a very powerful kind of study. And the psychological phrase is called selective attention, that we, given an agenda, will select out of our environment certain things. And that selecting out of the environment that we notice certain things means that we do not notice other things.
Right.
So the famous study of the, and just check, see if everybody's heard it or not, the basketball and the gorilla study. Anybody not heard that study? Okay, I will review this then. So there's a study that they did where they told people that their job watching, that they were going to be watching a video, and their job was to count the number of times a basketball passed between players. And particularly, there were different teams on the floor, so some had white shirts and some had a different color shirt. And they said, count the number of times it passes between the players with the white shirts. So that was, you know, you had to kind of track. You had to be pretty focused to do that task. And so they ran the video, and people largely could get the right answer of the number of times the basketball was passed. A few people also kind of asked the questions like, was there like a gorilla that walked through that video? And There had been. A guy in a gorilla suit had come out right into the middle of the floor and kind of like stood there dancing around for a little while and then walked off. Most people did not see the gorilla. Because of that agenda. You know, so it's like we take in things based on our preconceived ideas and we don't take other things in. It's like some of the people, I mean, what was even more amazing in that study, it's like we don't see the gorilla. That's actually normal. You know, it's like our mind is focused. We have to know, though, that our mind focuses and doesn't see everything. It's really important to know this. Because, you know, it's like we assume we see everything. And this whole, like, you know, in courtrooms, this is a huge issue, I think. You know, people claiming, I was there, I would have seen X or Y. Well, maybe not, you know, because our minds do this kind of focusing thing. And we bring agendas in. So, you know, seeing a particular person that looks in a particular way. We have views and ideas about what they do and don't do, and we see that. So this is a huge area of the mind, constructing things. So, you know, so most people in watching that video, then hearing about the gorilla, and then watching it back go, wow, that's amazing, I didn't see the gorilla. A few people, something like, you know, some number, like 20% of the people who didn't see the gorilla, said, that's a different video. I would have seen the gorilla. That's delusion. That's a powerful, you know, denial of the way our systems work. And so it's really important to understand that our minds are not taking in everything. It is being selective. And that selective is largely because of the mental formations. Our views, our ideas, our opinions, our agendas, even something as simple as watch the number of times a basketball passes, a simple agenda can affect what we see and don't see. So these four processes kind of come together. You know, they're mostly working, not me trying to do them, but they're mostly just working, and that's the mind relating to experience. So those four processes kind of relate to experience, and there's both the preconceived ideas that shape how we meet things, and then things that arise, those mental formations, those views, those ideas, those beliefs arise in dependence on what has come, and then shapes further things. So that's the kind of... Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay. So, I mean, this is not something simple to understand. It is not. This is... And we grow in our understanding through seeing. I mean, so we can hear it and kind of process it intellectually, but the more we start to see in our experience and have even just a little kind of framework here of... Well, there are processes of mind that relate to experience, and that's how this being works. You know, that when we see, we can begin to see with mindfulness those processes at work. It supports us understanding how we get caught. It supports understanding that these processes are not me, not mine. They are just processes. And all of that helps the mind to kind of let go of the ways in which it's habitually stuck. I'd say, you know, so in terms of the question, what is mind, what is mindfulness trying to figure it out, I would say don't try to figure it out. It's more the be with experience. Right. And maybe a little bit of understanding of there are processes at work. But just, I mean, what you described earlier about your experience showed some kind of understanding of those processes. You know, that you said you saw the thought, and then there's more things going on. And then there was the question, why am I at that thought? And there was the understanding, there are conditions. And so without trying to figure that out, just being there, that understanding happened. And so that's more the way that the understanding kind of filters in.
Right. I don't